Dune by Frank Herbert, continued. The Baron weighed this disclosure, then, "What has Arrakis to do with this?"
"It provides a pool of recruits already conditioned to the bitterest survival training."
The Baron shook his head.
"You cannot mean the Fremen."
"I mean the Fremen."
"Ha! Then why warn Rabban? There cannot be more than a handful of Fremen left after the Sardaukar pogrom and Rabban's oppression."
Howitt continued to stare at him silently.
"Not more than a handful," the Baron repeated. "Rabban killed 6,000 of them last year alone."
Still, Howitt stared at him.
"And the year before it was 9,000, the Baron said. "And before they left, the Sardaukar must have accounted for at least 20,000.
"What are Rabban's troop losses for the past 2 years?" Howitt asked.
The Baron rubbed his jowls.
"Well, he has been recruiting rather heavily, to be sure. His agents make rather extravagant promises, and
shall we say 30,000 in round numbers?" Howitt asked.
"That would seem a little high," the Baron said.
"Quite the contrary," Howitt said. "I can read between the lines of Rabban's reports as well as you can. And you certainly must have understood my reports from our agents."
"Arrakis is a fierce planet," the Baron said. "Storm losses can—"
"We both know the figure for storm accretion," Howitt said.
"What if he has lost 30,000? The Baron demanded,
and blood darkened his face.
"By your own count," Howitt said, "he killed 15,000 over 2 years, while losing twice that number. You say the Sardaukar accounted for another 20,000, possibly a few more. And I've seen the transportation manifests for their return from Arrakis. If they killed 20,000, they lost almost 5 for 1. Why won't you face these figures, Baron, and understand what they mean?"
The Baron spoke in a coldly measured cadence.
"This is your job, Mentat. What do they mean?"
"I gave you Duncan Idaho's head count on the siege he visited," Howitt said. "It all fits. If they had just 250 such siege communities, their population would be about 5 million. My best estimate is that they had at least twice that many communities. You scatter your population on such a planet."
10 million?
The Baron's jowls quivered with amazement.
"At least."
The Baron pursed his fat lips. The beady eye stared without wavering at Howitt.
"Is this true Mentat computation?" he wondered. "How could this be, and no one suspect?"
"We haven't even cut heavily into their birth rate growth figure," Howitt said. "We've just weeded out some of their less successful specimens, leaving the strong to grow stronger, just like on Seleucia Secundus."
"Seleucia Secundus," the Baron barked. "What has this to do with the Emperor's prison planet?"
"A man who survives Seleucia Secundus starts out being tougher than most others," Howitt said. "When you add the very best of military training—"
"Nonsense! By your argument, I could recruit from among the Fremen, after the way they've been oppressed by my nephew."
Howitt spoke in a mild voice.
"Don't you oppress any of your troops?"
"Well, I... but..."
"Oppression is a relative thing," Howitt said. "Your fighting men are much better off than those around them, hey? They see unpleasant alternative to being soldiers of the Baron, hey?"
The Baron fell silent, eyes unfocused. The possibilities—had Rabban unwittingly given House Harkonnen its ultimate weapon? Presently, he said,
"How could you be sure of the loyalty of such recruits?"
"I would take them in small groups, not larger than platoon strength," Howitt said. "I'd remove them from their oppressive situation and isolate them with a training cadre of people who understood their background, preferably people who had preceded them from the same oppressive situation. Then I'd fill them with the mystique that their planet had really been a secret training ground to produce just such superior beings as themselves. And all the while, I'd show them what such superior beings could earn—rich living, beautiful women, fine mansions, whatever they desired."
The Baron began to nod.
"The way the Sardaukar live at home."
"The recruits come to believe, in time, that such a place as Seleucia Secundus is justified because it produced them. The elite. The commonest Sardaukar trooper lives a life, in many respects, as exalted as that of any member of a great house."
"Such an idea," the Baron whispered.
"You begin to share my suspicions," Howitt said.
"Where did such a thing start?" the Baron asked.
"Ah, yes. Where did House Corino originate? Were there people on Seleucus Secundus before the emperor sent his first contingents of prisoners there? Even the Duke Leto, a cousin on the distaff side, never knew for sure. Such questions are not encouraged."
The baron's eyes glazed with the thought.
"Yes, a very carefully kept secret. They'd use every device of... Besides, what's there to conceal?"
Howitt asked.
"That the Padishah Emperor has a prison planet? Everyone knows this. That he has Count Fenring," the baron blurted.
Howitt broke off, studied the baron with a puzzled frown.
"What of Count Fenring?" "At my nephew's birthday several years ago," the baron said, "this imperial popinjay, Count Fenring, came as official observer and to, conclude a business arrangement between the emperor and myself."
"So?"
During one of our conversations, I believe I said something about making a prison planet of Arrakis.
Fenring..." "What did you say exactly?"
Howitt asked.
"Exactly? That was quite a while ago, and..."
"My lord baron, if you wish to make the best use of my services, you must give me adequate information. Wasn't this conversation recorded?"
The baron's face darkened with anger.
"You're as bad as Piter. I don't like these..."
"Piter is no longer with you, my lord," Howitt said. "As to that, whatever did happen to Piter?"
"He became too familiar, too demanding of me," the baron said.
"You assure me you don't waste a useful man," Howitt said. "Will you waste me by threats and quibbling? We were discussing what you said to Count Fenring."
Slowly, the baron composed his features.
"When the time comes," he thought, "I'll remember his manner with me. Yes, I will remember."
"One moment," the baron said, and he thought back to the meeting in his great hall. It helped to visualize the cone of silence in which they had stood.
"I said something like this," the baron said. "The emperor knows a certain amount of killing has always been an arm of business. I was referring to our workforce losses. Then I said something about considering another solution to the Arrakeen problem, and I said the emperor's prison planet inspired me to emulate him."
"Witch blood," Howitt snapped. "What did Fenring say?"
"That's when he began questioning me about you."
Howitt sat back, closed his eyes, and thought.
"So that's why they started looking into Arrakis," he said. "Well, the thing's done."
He opened his eyes.
"They must have spies all over Arrakis by now. 2 years.
But certainly my innocent suggestion that nothing is innocent in an emperor's eyes.
What were your instructions to Rabban?"
"Merely that he should teach Arrakis to fear us."
Howitt shook his head.
"You now have two alternatives, Baron. You can kill off the natives, wipe them out entirely, or
waste an entire workforce.
Would you prefer to have the Emperor and those great houses he can still swing behind him come in here and perform a curetment, scrape out Gedi Prime like a hollow gourd?"
The Baron studied his mentat, then...
"He wouldn't dare."
"Wouldn't he?"
The Baron's lips quivered.
"What is your alternative?"
"Abandon your dear nephew, Rabban."
"Abandon..."
The Baron broke off, stared at Howitt.
"Send him no more troops, no aid of any kind. Don't answer his messages, other than to say you've heard of the terrible way he's handled things on Arrakis, and you intend to take corrective measures as soon as you're able. I'll arrange to have some of your messages intercepted by Imperial spies."
"But what of the spice, the revenues, the..."
"Demand your baronial profits. But be careful how you make your demands. Require fixed sums of Rabban. We can..."
The Baron turned his hands, palms up.
"But how can I be certain that my weasel nephew isn't..."
"We still have our spies on Arrakis. Tell Rabban he either meets the spice quotas you set him, or he'll be replaced."
"I know my nephew," the Baron said. "This would only make him oppress the population even more."
"Of course he will," Howitt snapped. "You don't want that stopped now. You merely want your own hands clean. Let Rabban make your Seleucus Secundus for you. There's no need even to send him any prisoners. He has all the population required. If Rabban is driving his people to meet your spice quotas, then the Emperor need suspect no other motive. That's reason enough for putting the planet on the rack. And you, Baron, will not show by word or action that there's any other reason for this."
The Baron could not keep the sly tone of admiration out of his voice.
Ah, Howitt, you are a devious one. Now, how do we move into Arrakis and make use of what Raban prepares?
That's the simplest thing of all, Baron. If you set each year's quota a bit higher than the one before, matters will soon reach a head there. Production will drop off. You can remove Raban and take over yourself to correct the mess.
It fits, the Baron said. But I can feel myself tiring of all this. I'm preparing another to take over Arrakis for me.
Howitt studied the fat round face across from him. Slowly the old soldier spy began to nod his head.
Fade Rotha, he said. So that's the reason for the oppression now. You're very devious yourself, Baron. Perhaps we can incorporate these two schemes. Yes. Your Fade Rotha can go to Arrakis as their savior. He can win the populace. Yes.
The Baron smiled, and behind his smile he asked himself,
Now, how does this fit in with Howitt's personal scheming?
And Howitt, seeing that he was dismissed, arose and left the red-walled room. As he walked, he could not put down the disturbing unknowns that cropped into every computation about Arrakis. This new religious leader that Gurney Halleck hinted at from his hiding place among the smugglers, this Muad'Dib.
Perhaps I should not have told the Baron to let this religion flourish where it will, even among the folk of Pan and Graben, he told himself. But it's well known that repression makes a religion flourish.
And he thought about Halleck's reports on Fremen battle tactics. The tactics smacked of Halleck himself, and Idaho, and even of Howitt.
Did Idaho survive? He asked himself.
But this was a futile question. He did not yet ask himself if it was possible that Paul had survived. He knew the Baron was convinced that all Atreides were dead. The Bene Gesserit witch had been his weapon, the Baron admitted, and that could only mean an end to all, even to the woman's own son.
What a poisonous hate she must have had for the Atreides, he thought. Something like the hate I hold for this Baron. Will my blow be as final and complete as hers?
There is in all things a pattern that is part of our universe. It has symmetry, elegance, and grace, those qualities you find always in that which the true artist captures. You can find it in the turning of the seasons, in the way sand trails along a ridge, in the branch clusters of the creosote bush, or the pattern of its leaves. We try to copy these patterns in our lives and our society, seeking the rhythms, the dances, the forms that comfort. Yet it is possible to see peril in the finding of ultimate perfection. It is clear that the ultimate pattern contains its own fixity. In such perfection, all things move toward death.
From The Collected Sayings of Muad'Dib by the Princess Irulan. Paul Muad'Dib remembered that there had been a meal heavy with spice essence. He clung to this memory because it was an anchor point, and he could tell himself from this vantage that his immediate experience must be a dream.
I am a theater of processes, he told himself. I am a prey to the imperfect vision, to the race consciousness and its terrible purpose.
Yet he could not escape the fear that he had somehow overrun himself, lost his position in time, so that past and future and present mingled without distinction. It was a kind of visual fatigue, and it came, he knew, from the constant necessity of holding the prescient future as a kind of memory that was in itself a thing intrinsically of the past.
Chani prepared the meal for me, he told himself.
Yet Chani was deep in the south, in the cold country where the sun was hot, secreted in one of the new siege strongholds, safe with their son, Leto II. Or was that a thing yet to happen?